Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Chagpar welcomes Dr. Frank Slack. Dr. Slack is professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Anish Chagpar.
So, Frank, you know, we read all the time about genomics and the genome and the whole Human Genome Project. Tell us a little bit about what exactly that is.
Okay, sure. The Human Genome Project was a very ambitious project conducted in the past 15 years or so. Very expensive project, but one that's definitely given us back so much valuable information and opened so many new avenues and doors. I liken the Human Genome Project to the way that the skies opened up with the discovery of telescopes. Without the human genome sequence or the string of all of the letters that make up a human being or the code for a human being, we really didn't have a good map of what made us human and what was similar amongst different humans and what was different in certain diseases. But having that human genome sequence has really allowed us to go and explore what are the differences in the genomes of healthy individuals versus diseased individuals or healthy tissue versus diseased tissue. And it's really helped us pinpoint the key genes that are involved in many different diseases. And no disease has benefited more than cancer right now. So much so that, in fact, the Human Genome Project has now morphed into the Cancer Genome Project, where people are basically sequencing individual cancer patients to find out how their genome is different from an uncancerous or a non-cancerous genome.
So tell me, is this the same thing as when people have genetic testing? So if they're at high risk, they go, they see a genetic counselor, and then they have genetic testing. Is that the same thing as genomics, or are they related? How does that work?
Right. They're definitely related. A genetic test would be, in general, would be the equivalent of just having one of your genes looked at, or even just one position in one of your genes looked at. One of those letters, the A, the G, the C, or the T, could be tested in one of those tests. Genomics is really the sum of all the genes in our genome. Up until the Human Genome Project, we really just had the ability to look at certain genes. For example, famous cancer genes like BRCA1, sometimes called BRCA1, could be tested, and you could see whether any of the letters A, C, Gs, or Ts were changed in your BRCA1 gene. But of course, many cancer patients don't have mutations in BRCA1. Now we're left with this challenge of trying to discover what's different about their genomes, and actually genomics would allow us now to examine their entire genome and find out the differences in all the genes that and if we're lucky, we'll find that there's one particular gene that just stands out as being definitely mutated in those patients, and that would be a gene that we could then focus on for some sort of targeted therapeutic.
So that sounds like that's a ton of information. Like how many genes do people have?
Right. Good question. Yeah, so the standard answer to that is that it's a moving target. Humans probably have the about 25,000 recognized genes. So you can think of that as sort of a lot of a haystack, and we need to find that one little needle in the haystack. So the human genome is made up of 3 billion of those letters, A, C, G's, and T's, and in some cases, it's just one of those that can be mutated, that can be the key in pushing a cell into a cancerous state. So finding that one particular change is equivalent to finding a needle in a haystack. We're getting better at identifying those needles more and more cheaply and more quickly, and to the point where it's not too far off that every cancer patient is likely to have their tumor genome sequenced as part of the workup that the oncologist will do for that patient.
So when you say that they may have their tumor sequenced, so that's different than a blood test for a normal patient who may be looking at their risk. You're looking actually at the tumor itself. How does that work?
Right. So I would say that it's almost certain that tumors are going to be sequenced. But in order to make a valid comparison, you need to have something to actually compare that to. Because everybody's genome is slightly different from everybody else's, probably what will happen is that not only will that patient have their tumor DNA sequence, but they'll also have their germline DNA sequence. That's DNA that's found in every cell, presumably in the normal cells in their body. Usually that comes from a cheek swab or from a blood draw or something like that. So there are two broad classes of mutations that are thought to influence cancer. There are those that are derived in individual cells that and lead to those cells becoming tumors. So those are sort of tumor-derived mutations. But then there are other mutations that actually get inherited that we can inherit from our parents that give us an increased susceptibility to cancer. The most famous one of those is the BRCA1 gene in breast cancer. But there are other cancer susceptibility loci that can be detected in a genome test or a genetic test from a blood draw. But it's generally accepted now that cancer is not a disease of just a single mutation or one gene going awry, but it's really a combination of many things coming together in the right combination that can drive the cancer. So knowing the complete genome sequence is probably going to be imperative to truly understand that individual's cancer.
So people could have their tumor sequenced and may have multiple different mistakes in different genes.
Right.
And so, but that leads me back to something that you said earlier, which is that part of the whole idea of doing genomics isn't just to find out where the mistake is, but to be able to target it, to be able to treat it, to be able to potentially prevent it. How does that happen?
Yeah. That is the goal of a lot of cancer research. In fact, I would say that we're probably ahead of ourselves to a certain extent. We probably know more about the genome of a cancer patient than we know about how to actually fix that cancer patient. But having that information is a very important first step. It's a handle that allows us to now go and test for drugs that can affect those particular mutant genes. So that's the ultimate goal is once we've discovered the complement of different mutant genes in a cancer patient, we want to then be able to test drugs that can specifically affect those cancer cells without affecting the normal cells that are not mutated. So, you know, that is the reason why cancer research is a fairly expensive operation, and it definitely explains why cancer is a disease that still hasn't had a cure after 30 years of trying to solve this problem. There have been some major breakthroughs made in our understanding of cancer over the last 30 years, so don't get me wrong. One thing that we've realized is that because cancer is a disease of our own cells and our own genes for the most part, and because everybody's genes are slightly different from everybody else's, or at least I should say everybody's genome is slightly different. We all have the same genes in general, but we might have different varieties of those genes. Everybody's cancer is slightly different from everybody else's. That's, I think, the big realization that we're coming to in this decade. And that means that ultimately every cancer patient is going to have to be personally treated for their complement of mutations and their complement of altered genes. And that's going to be very expensive. Luckily for us, the genome sequencing part is becoming a lot cheaper. And there's definitely talk about a cancer patient being able to have their tumor DNA sequenced for about $1,000, and that'll be something that'll be happening over the next few years. When that happens, it'll just become part of the medical record. Everybody will have their tumor DNA sequence. They'll have their germline DNA sequence. There'll be a computer program that will match and compare those two and find the mutations that look different or the regions of the genome that look different in the tumor relative to the normal. cells, and we'll be able to then hopefully identify a handful of key genes that we will know drugs work against, and that patient will quickly go on to a regimen of drugs that we have a pretty good idea work against that particular set of genes.
So tell us a little bit more about the genome. I mean, all of us who are sitting here listening to NPR are remembering back to grade 7 biology and genes and DNA and RNA. And so when we talk about a gene, are we talking about the DNA sequence? Are we talking about RNA? Are we talking about coding regions, non-coding regions, all of it, some of it?
Yeah.
How does that work?
That is an excellent question, and things have dramatically changed since we were all in high school, that's for sure. The concept of a gene from a geneticist point of view hasn't changed. A gene is a stretch of DNA that carries some hereditary information, some information that can get passed down from one cell to the next cell or from one parent to the children. But what we now understand of a gene in terms of how it looks structurally in the genome, that has changed quite dramatically. In the past, we thought of a gene as basically being a piece of DNA that coded for some protein sequence, and the gene generally was thought of as being from the punctuation mark that tells you to start making the protein to the punctuation mark that told you to stop making the protein. We now know that there's a lot more information in the genome, even in the sequences those letters that flank the punctuation mark start and stop, that should probably be considered part of the gene. These are parts that will promote the use of the gene, parts that will stop the use of the gene. They are also important parts of a gene. More importantly, we now know that not all genes, in fact, code for proteins. Not all genes have these start and stop punctuation marks. There are genes that make other types of molecules that are equally important in the cell, or at least they code for other molecules. If you include now our broader understanding of a gene, we probably have many more than 25,000 genes in our genome. We have 25,000 protein coding genes, and many, many more genes that code for other kinds of molecules, most commonly RNA molecules, related to DNA, but they also have the ability to actually do work within a cell and carry information around in cells.
So are people looking at those RNAs? Are people looking at that? And what do they have any influence on cancer?
Right. So I would say over the last 10 years, things have dramatically changed in our view of genes and our view of what gets made in a normal cell, what gets made in a cancerous cell. And in fact, one of the great revelations, and in fact, it's the research that my lab focuses on most intensely now, are these other kinds of RNAs that are being made within cells. The most famous of the cancer-causing genes, things like BRCA1 and RAS and MYC, which are commonly mutated genes in cancer, they do code for proteins. And in fact, we know a lot about those particular proteins. Those proteins do very, very important things within cells. But over the past 20 years or so, we've come to realize that cells make a lot of so-called non-coding RNAs. These are RNAs that don't actually code for proteins. And in fact, they do play important roles in cancer. That's something that we're working on quite intensely.
So I'd love to learn more about those microRNAs and how they work in cancer. We're going to do that right after we take a short break for a medical minute. So please stay tuned to learn more information about oncogenes, microRNAs, and cancer.
The American Cancer Society estimates that the lifetime risk of developing colorectal cancer is about 1 in 20, and that the risk is slightly lower in women than in men. When detected early, colorectal cancer is easily treated and highly curable. Men and women over the age of 50 should have regular colonoscopies to screen for the disease. Each day, more patients are surviving colorectal cancer due to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care, which is giving colorectal cancer survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for colorectal cancer. New options include a Chinese herbal medicine being used in combination with chemotherapy to reduce side effects of treatment and help cancer drugs work more effectively. This has been a Medical Minute, and more information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by our guest, Dr. Frank Slack. So right before the break, Frank, we were talking about oncogenes, we were talking about cancer, and how genes can actually be influencing the development of cancer. And you were telling us about these areas of RNA which have an influence on that. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So over the past few years, we've discovered that there are many RNAs that are being made within cells. We still actually, I feel like we're at the real tip of the iceberg in understanding what these RNAs are doing. There's thousands of these little RNAs being made in cells, and it's a real challenge and a real area of exciting research to try and figure out exactly what they're doing. One of those classes of RNAs are called microRNAs, something that we've worked on for a long time. My lab initially studied them for roles in development, and development is meaning the development of the embryo. Development is tightly linked to cancer. Many of the genes involved in development are ultimately also found to be involved in cancer. And so we were drawn by an understanding of some of these microRNAs and their roles in cancer into what they might be in development into what they might be doing in cancer. So microRNAs are small RNAs. If you can picture a typical RNA in a cell being about 2,000 of these letters long, so 2,000 A's, C's, and G's or T's, a microRNA is only about 20 of these letters long. So very small. But their small size doesn't mean that they have very little to do in the cell. They, in fact, have a pretty important role in the cell. They actually act to regulate or to control the use of other genes. So their function is not to fold up into some sort of an enzyme or some sort of structure that can catalyze a reaction, but rather they go and bind to other genes and determine whether that gene is going to be on or off. So they act as these important switches, and some of these microRNAs we've discovered and other groups have found as well act to turn on and off important oncogenes in a cell. So one thing to keep in mind about an oncogene is that it is a mutated gene, but that mutated gene actually in its normal role when it's unmutated has a very, very important function, but usually that function is during development. So oncogenes typically will be involved in massive amounts of cell division that are required in the early embryo. You can picture a single-celled embryo. That's how we all start out, and we have to grow into an embryo of 200 trillion cells, so you need to have lots of cell division in the early embryo, and these oncogenes are the genes that are driving that cell division. They get switched off over time as we get bigger and bigger, and we need less and less cells. In a cancer, those oncogenes get reactivated again. Or if there's some way that you can mess up the block of on those oncogenes, you can actually start a cell dividing again. It sort of acts like it's in the early embryo and it starts to divide out of control. So we've discovered that some of these microRNA genes control some of these cell division or proliferation activating genes. So that's been exciting because for a few reasons. First of all, we've discovered a new class of cancer genes, and that's always good information to have. Secondly, because these genes, these microRNAs are only 20 of these nucleotides long, they're so small that we can in fact synthesize them in a laboratory. We can make them in a test tube, and we can give them to cancer cells and see whether they can suppress those oncogenes in a cancer cell and have a therapeutic benefit. And that's been an area that we've been moving into over the last few years.
So if I understand this right, so your body makes these microRNAs, and the job of the microRNAs is to turn on and off genes. And so normally they would potentially turn off genes that would otherwise, if left not turned off, would go and make cancer. Mm-hmm. So how come, is it ever that the microRNAs are mutated as well, and so that they don't stop the cancer genes from turning on as much as they should?
Right. That's an excellent question. I mean, we actually got into this particular area because we noticed that some of these microRNA genes just weren't being expressed at the same, or weren't being made at the same level in cancer cells as they were in normal cells. And the very first example of that was a microRNA that we found with some of our collaborators to be very, very poorly expressed, or very, very poorly made at very low levels in lung cancer cells relative to normal lung cancer cells. And so we suspected then that something was happening to that gene. Either it was being it had been deleted from the cancer cells, or in some way there were mutations within it leading to it being an unstable gene, and it was just not functioning at the right level. Subsequent to that, we now know that these microRNA genes are definitely altered in cancer. So they can be mutated. They can be deleted. They can be amplified. All the sorts of things that you might anticipate for other cancer genes can happen to these types of genes as well. So definitely, this knowledge has increased the scope or the span of genes that we now know can be mutated and misregulated in cancer.
So what turns on and off the production of a microRNA?
Right. So the microRNA genes are very similar to our other genes. They have the same general promoting regions and regulatory regions that our normal genes do. So you can imagine there are proteins that will in fact bind to DNA and actually activate the use of genes. Some of the same proteins that will activate and bind to a gene like BRCA1, for example, might also bind to and activate one of these microRNA genes. So they are not that different from some of the well-known cancer genes, just that they do not code for proteins in the end. Their sole function appears to be just to go and bind to other genes and shut them off or reduce the level of their use.
So, Frank, does their altered production only happen in tumor cells, or would it also happen in normal cells?
Right. So that's a great question too. These microRNA genes are definitely not statically made. So it's not like in all times in our development, the microRNAs are always on or they're always off. One of the key things that these microRNAs do is that they get turned on and off at precise times during our development, so that we can allow cells to, for example, stop dividing so quickly or to start to convert themselves from a stem cell or a cell that can make many cells into a particular kind of cell within the early embryo. So these microRNAs have functions in development. And those are dynamic functions. So they get made at particular times, and then they get shut off again when that microRNA is no longer needed. And so definitely this extends to the cancer cells as well. So certain cancers will make reduced amounts of some of these microRNAs, and other types of microRNAs might get upregulated in some of those cancer cells. So it's definitely a dynamic state.
So one of the things that's really intriguing, though, is that if you can make these microRNAs in a test tube, then you can give them to people. Do they actually get into the cancer cells or to turn off those genes, or do they get into normal cells, or how does that work?
Right. Yeah, good point. So if you just would inject into the bloodstream or give a pill that would be taken orally and go into the stomach of an RNA molecule, it doesn't last very well in our bodies. RNA is not a very stable molecule, but over the past 5 years or so, some very, very smart chemists and bioengineers have figured out ways to make these RNAs very stable so that they're still functional, but they don't get degraded within our bodies. And I think that is definitely accelerating the chances that these microRNAs are going to one day become therapeutics in cancer patients. So just, I should be clear here that at this point, no cancer patient has taken a microRNA as a therapeutic. This is not something you can do yet, but clinical trials are definitely being planned for the next few years. But a lot of work in mouse models of cancer has shown that these tricks, these stabilizing tricks, these ways to encapsulate the RNAs in nanoparticles and other kinds of lipid particles that can survive within cells, within our blood, and can then target these things to cells, definitely work very well. So I don't think it's going to be a big leap for us to be able to show that these also function in humans.
Do you foresee that? I mean, and okay, we're daydreaming towards the future, but do you foresee a way for these microRNA nanoparticles to be targeted to particular cancer cells so that that microRNA goes into the tumor cell and turns on or off particular genes that are oncogenes versus going into normal cells where you may need them?
Right. Excellent. Yeah. So I didn't answer your question fully last time, which was do they get into normal cells? With current technology, we don't yet have a way to exclude them from normal cells. However, we're collaborating, as I mentioned earlier, with some very smart bioengineers, even some here at Yale, Dr. Mark Saltzman, for example, to make these nanoparticles be specific for cancer cells or to target the cancer cells in their environment. And I would say that we're getting some very encouraging success with those strategies. So basically trying to put on the surface of the nanoparticles warheads that will target just to the cancer cells. That's the holy grail of the field right now, to try and get this to deliver the payload to the bad cells, but to avoid the good cells that are surrounding them.
That is so cool. So do you foresee a time when we could even use this in the preventative setting, find genes that are mutated that increase your risk, and put in the microRNAs up front that prevent the oncogenes from turning on?
Right. That would be an amazing thing if it could happen. I mean, at this point, I don't think anybody's realistically thinking of a preventative trial. People are definitely thinking about microRNAs in a therapeutic sense. So once a patient already presents with a cancer. But I can imagine that in, you know, 20 years, when we know enough about these types of genes and we've solved the sort of whole therapy issue and we can now divert attention to actually preventing the cancers from happening in the first place, I would imagine that these would be fine cancer preventatives as well. Ultimately, you know, we were talking earlier about cancer genomes being sequenced, but I really foresee a day when every child pretty much at birth is going to get a blood test and they'll have their genome just sequenced. The pediatrician will examine that genome and they'll be able to say, well, you have some predisposition to this disease or that disease, and we actually have some things that we think I might be able to help you prevent those diseases. And microRNAs could end up being a preventative along those lines for sure. It would be a great day for medicine when that happens, but I think it is a fairly long way off. It's not something my lab is even thinking about right now.
So, Frank, in the last 30 seconds, tell us what you think will be the greatest advance in microRNAs and genomics in the next 5 years.
Oh, well, so I can say that having the human genome opened up this whole world to us. Before the human genome, we knew about only one of these microRNA genes in the whole of biology. After the human genome sequence was done, we discovered, well, we and the field have discovered at least 1,500 of these microRNA genes. And so this list just keeps growing and growing. And I think that, as I mentioned earlier, getting to the bottom of this iceberg is going to be the most exciting thing. Finding out what's really out there, how many RNAs are really made, and how we can harness those for our own benefit. That'll be the most exciting thing.
Dr. Frank Slack is professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at the Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.